President Wilkinson, faculty of the Brigham Young University, and you wonderful students, I esteem it an honor to have the privilege of addressing you briefly this morning. And before I start on the topic that I wish to speak about, I would like to tell you how proud I am of you for the contribution you made during our past General Conference of the Church. I think there's nothing thrills people more than wonderful music. And it was the great chorus of the Brigham Young University who provided the music for the Friday sessions of conference, and you'll never know it, but people are talking about you all over this church. I should add, too, that later in the conference, the contribution of Brother Bentley to the great MIA organization was also made, and I'm sure Brother Bentley's in for a tremendous experience, largely with the young people of the church. I have a deep and abiding testimony of the gospel. I have some wonderful experiences that come to me, and I would say one of the greatest is to sit in the presence of who I like to feel are the three great men living in this earth today, the first presidency of our church. And if I have no other testimony, I have this testimony to bear to you, that I know with all my soul this church is guided by revelation from on high. As I sit in meetings with these great leaders of ours and hear the great questions propounded to them, I often wonder how anyone could answer them other than through the still small voice that whispers the answer to them. And I've felt many times that the veil between these great leaders and the other side is so thin that they can all but converse back and forth. It's a great honor and a great privilege that I enjoy as a member of the presiding bishopric to sit in their presence at least twice each week and sometimes oftener than this. Now, when I was here to your quarterly conference, I spoke a little about my early life and my parents, and I don't know whether I would repeat if I accepted President Wilkinson's offer to say a little bit more about my humble beginning. My father's father died when he was 6 years of age. When he was 6.5 years of age, he received his first employment working for a wealthy banker in the banker's stables, assisting with caring for his fine horses. And this work my father had to assist a little bit in helping to support his mother and some of the younger children of the family until he became 17 or 18 years of age. Like every other young man in that land, they gave 2 years to the army, and he gave his 2 years. And shortly after that time, became married. And at about that time, the Mormon missionaries contacted them, and I've often wondered why they were the two of a city who heard the missionaries, who accepted it. Elder Thomas E. McKay, who just recently passed away, one of our wonderful general authorities, was one of those who aided in the conversion of my father and mother. And early in the spring of 1901, like many others who joined the church in those early days, emigrated to the headquarters of the church and to the place where a temple had been erected to our Heavenly Father. I think I told you that my father's first employment when he got here was assisting in the laying of streetcar rails for the Utah Traction Company on the west side of Temple Square in Salt Lake City. They worked 10 hours a day. He got 10 cents an hour. So he earned $1 a day He had a wife and two children. They had to rent a home. He had to feed us and clothe us and pay medical expenses. But there was no complaint. He was in America, in this great land of the free. And he had a testimony of the gospel, and he was near the headquarters of the church. And while things were difficult in our early life, my father never, ever forgot why he came here to America. And I'm grateful for that. And since then, six of us have been able to serve on missions, five to the same land in which he was converted. When I went on mine, no missionaries could go to Europe anywhere because of the food situation there. And I served my 2 years in the eastern states. The topic I wanted to speak about briefly today is one of the assignments that comes to me as a member of the presiding bishopric that you don't hear too much about from that point of view. But one of my assignments has to do with the welfare program of the church. I'm a great believer in the church welfare program, and I've seen its blessings among the people of the church. Now, in my early life, I saw the welfare program lived by my father. Eight other children were born in our home. Economically, we had a very difficult time. My father became a humble cement contractor after a couple of years here. And in the fall, when the freezing weather began, work just stopped and didn't commence again until the thaw came in the spring. I think the only way we ever pulled through the winters in those days was because he bought 20 or 30 sacks of flour and 25 or 30 bushels of potatoes and that many bushels of apples, and probably always had a hog or two killed that hung up in our upstairs, the best deep freeze I was ever in. I used to sleep with them up there, and I know how cold it was. I've often thought many times I might never have appeared in the morning had I not taken a warm brick to bed with me at night before retiring. Well, those things helped us through the winter. We've been teaching those same things now for more than 20 years, that we should look ahead and lay a little aside for a day that might overtake us. And I've seen that thing happen in the lives of many people. I've wondered often, why such an emphasis on the welfare program? And as I think about it, I think, what are we more interested in anyway than our own security, than our own welfare? Why are we here to receive an education? It's because we're interested in taking care of the things that the physical body is going to demand from us. When we establish a home and our responsibilities increase, we want to be sure that we're good providers. And when the little ones come in the home, we'd like to be able to take care of those youngsters. So often, we don't only work 8 hours a day, but we'll work 10 or 12 or even 16 hours a day because we're interested in doing all that's expected of us to take care of those for whom we have a responsibility. Welfare, security, we're all interested in security. And yet there are many people, in spite of all the effort they put forth, that are having problems and difficulties. And were it not for a great church to help some of these people, they wouldn't enjoy the same blessings that we enjoy. Well, I've often thought, as I've looked at an audience like you, or even a group at a quarterly conference of the church, that there's very little difference between those today who have all of the things they'd like to enjoy and those who are receiving assistance. Maybe one day those now receiving assistance had everything they wished to, but something happened in their lives. I've read and you've read. I just read two or three days ago again, where fire struck the home of a family a second time. It all but got all they had the first time and completely wiped them out this time. I've seen many pictures in a paper where all you see is the little foundation that's left, the charred ruins of the furniture in the background, possibly the father and mother and 6 or 7 or 8 children standing in front of these charred ruins, and if they're fortunate, the bishop or the president of the elders' quorum, and under is the caption that says, "While the family were away last night, fire struck their home and destroyed everything that they possessed except the clothes they had on their backs." That has happened not only once or twice, but that happens many times. I clipped a little piece out of the paper just a day or two ago, and this is what it said. 518 Utahns die in accidents. Some 518 Utahns were killed during 1957 in accidents, and 39,800 other persons were injured. Accidents also caused property losses of $43.5 million. That's in the state of Utah alone, where we're predominantly members of the church. And I'm sure it's not unreasonable to say that the majority of those who lost their lives and the majority of the $43.5 million loss was sustained by members of the church. And I've wondered how much of that loss and how much assistance has been given to the families of those who've lost the head of the family and of those who maybe have had other difficulties and accidents. Just a few days ago, I was speaking at an elders' school graduation exercise where inactive elders had been brought together, and a man was brought in a wheelchair, a man who 3 years ago had been stricken with polio, a very wonderful person. I had known the man for a long time. His wife was wheeling him into the meeting. She took him home again from the meeting, but after the meeting was over, the counselor in the stake presidency said, "Every morning, the 70s quorum come and pick up this good brother and take him to his shop. He can work there 8 hours a day sitting in his wheelchair. And every evening, the 70s quorum come and take him back to his home." The 70s quorum have made his life happy and livable through the service they give to him in his condition. You'd be amazed at the enthusiasm and the joy that radiates from the man who sits in the wheelchair nearly all of the waking hours of his life because someone have gone out of their way to help him be economically independent and take care of his wife and the responsibilities that have come to him. Often things happen to us over which we have no control. I was in Farmington, New Mexico here 2 or 3 years ago, attending a quarterly conference. And while I was there with one of the welfare committeemen, we went to the bishop's storehouse. Farmington, New Mexico is an area of orchards. I think I've never been in any one place that has as many fruit trees as in and around Farmington, New Mexico. As we inspected the bishop's storehouse, to my amazement, we found no fruit in the storehouse. And I made the observation that it's an unusual thing to be in an area as productive of fruit as this area is and come into the bishop's storehouse and not see any fruit at all. And then the manager of the storehouse said, "But Bishop, you heard, didn't you, that we had a very serious frost this spring that took the entire fruit crop. We haven't any fruit in our area this year." And we had none to put in the bishop's storehouse. And then I began to wonder how many families in that area might be in difficulty. How many may lose their farm to the banker? How many may not have the food that they ought to have to sustain them until another fruit crop might come? And what can the church do through the welfare program to help families in an area such as that area. Well, it's not an uncommon thing to learn of droughts and of floods and of freezing and of many other things that happen that might cut off your economic source of supply, your income, and create for you a very difficult period of time. Now, maybe it isn't always that way either. Maybe we create our own. Somebody wrote this, I think, more in the way of a joke than anything else, but I'd like to read it to you. A man lived by the side of the road and sold hot dogs. He was hard of hearing, so he had no radio. He had trouble with his eyes, so he had no newspaper. But he sold good hot dogs. He put up a sign on the highway telling how good they were. He stood by the side of the road and cried, "Buy a hot dog, mister," and people bought. He increased his meat and bun orders, and he bought a bigger stove to take care of his trade. He got his son home from college to help him. His son said, "Father, haven't you been listening to the radio? There's a big depression on. The international situation is terrible, and the domestic situation is even worse." Whereupon the father thought, "Well, my son has been to college. He listens to the radio and he reads the papers, so he ought to know." So the father cut down on the bun order, took down his advertising signs, and no longer bothered to stand on the highway to sell hot dogs. His hot dog sales fell almost overnight. "You were right, son," the father said to the boy. "We are certainly in the middle of a great depression." That may not be the best story to read in an institution of learning such as I am in this morning, but it impressed me very much anyway. I've had the feeling that one of the finest things we can do to help each other in the welfare program is to find employment for those who need employment. And as I've analyzed this situation, I've also had the feeling that we have no greater employment bureaus in the world than our priesthood quorums. Have you ever thought about that? I belong to a priesthood quorum that has 300 high priests in it. Were I unemployed and needed assistance, who could help me better than the 300 men to whom I belong, who represent nearly every industry in the whole community, who know me, my personality, and my ability to work? And I've thought many times, if my own priesthood quorum can't find me a job, 98% of the opportunity of me ever receiving work has probably been lost. Now, if our priesthood quorums could just catch the vision of the great possibilities they have in helping our members enjoy the same thing they would like to enjoy, economic independence, and how what a great asset and help they could be in aiding their members to secure this kind of help, I think our priesthood quorums would probably have 80 or 90% of their members present every Sunday morning, because a man just couldn't afford not to be active and part of that great organization. Then I think, too, of the great work being done for those who are handicapped, old folks, some who've lost maybe one of the members of their body, some whose vision is bad, some who have heart trouble, some who can only have a sit-down job, and others who can only stand up and work who can't sit down, but people who can't fit in the regular channels of labor. We have 300 or 400 of this kind working now in what we call our Deseret Industries, and if you've never been to a Deseret Industries Center and seen the thrill and the happiness and joy in the lives of these people, I'll tell you, you've missed a great opportunity in your life. First, you'll thank the Lord that you're able to do the things you're able to do. And second, you'll thank the Lord that in part of his program, he's provided a place where these people can feel that they're economically independent and where their services are worth something and where they're making a contribution to aid and assist others who might still be worse off than they are. Well, now, where do we get the stocks that go into a bishop's storehouse after all anyway? We have two great sources from which come all of the assets in the welfare program. One of those is these production projects. And I've thought what a wonderful thing they are and how different they are from any other way of giving relief to people. If you own the land and you own the coop and you own the chickens in the coop, one of two things is always going to happen. You're either going to have eggs in the bishop's storehouse, or if the chickens don't come through, you can excommunicate them and you can always have chicken meat in the bishop's storehouse to eat, can't you? But the big thing is, if we own the project and we own the entire thing, we're always going to have something in the storehouse to take out of the storehouse. Same with a cattle project or any of these farming projects. They produce the item that goes into the store. Now, I think you, most of you, don't remember the next period I'd like to refer to, but you've heard enough about it to let you know that money isn't always the answer to all of our problems. During the lean years of what we call the Depression years, when about half of the people of the nation were unemployed, you could go in any grocery store and see it stocked from the floor to the ceiling. And you just stood there wishing you had something in your pocket with which to buy the commodities that you could see. But most of us didn't have the money. Then I remember a few years later when we entered into the Second Great World War. And immediately the economic situation of the nation spiraled. And we had money. We went to the same grocery store. And what were we greeted by? A ration book. You could only get a pair of shoes once in a while. You couldn't get the meat that you'd like to get. You couldn't get butter and fats. You couldn't get bread, and you couldn't get flour. You couldn't get paper product. You couldn't get soap. The common staples that we use every day were now all rationed. You had the money you couldn't buy because the supply was short. It isn't always money that counts, is it? But when you produce it yourself and you put it in the storehouse, can you see that our storehouse will always have something in it? We're not dependent on the economic situation of the nation if we own and control, operate, and teach our people, particularly those who need assistance, to help us produce and put into the storehouse the things they consume. That, to me, is what makes the welfare program a great program and entirely different from anything else I know anything about. Now, the other asset we have in the program is the fast offering part of it. That's the only cash actually we should ever have to raise when we have acquired a producing project. And it's that part of it that comes under my direction as a member of the presiding bishopric. When bishops need fast offerings over and above those they collect in their own wards to take care of the needs of their worthy members, they can request from the presiding bishopric surplus fast offerings. And I might tell you now that the fast offerings annually amount to about $1,750,000. Since I've been there, we've never had enough fast offering to take care of the requests of the bishops for the hospitalization of members of the church and for the other needs that bishops request these surplus fast offerings. It might interest you to know that in 1 year's time, more than $1 million goes for hospitalization of members of the church alone. When you get all these things together, this thing begins to take on some tremendous proportions. 69,000 people were helped by the church last year through the welfare program. And economically, these are still good years. What do you think might happen? And what the draw might be on the church should we get in a little further recession than the one we're in right now? I think we have a tremendous program, and I, for one, am thrilled that the church is willing to help our brother, be our brother's keeper, to love our neighbor. And I say again, we never know from one day to the next when we'll be on the other side. I've often felt this, that the person who's willing to share while he has it may never ever have to ask anyone for any assistance. And should that blessing come to any of us, I'm sure that's a greater blessing than most of us would ever expect to receive for being willing to share. Now, I come back again to the time I attended your quarterly conference. I've talked about you a great deal in this stake. You hold the record in this entire church for the per capita payment of fast offerings of any stake in the church. As I recall, when I was here, I had an 11-month report that said you had paid up to that time $4.68 in the 11 months. I assume with the 12th month, it probably is $5 per capita. That's far better than any stake that I know anything about in this church. You had some other records that I observed when I was here that have made me say to people all over, no wonder the blessings of our Heavenly Father are with the Brigham Young University. The devotion of those attending this school call forth those blessings. And I think our Father in Heaven will never ever forsake the person who's willing to do that which He has asked him to do. Now, with this payment of fast offering are attached great blessings, many wonderful blessings. I've got a whole stack of cards that have nothing but quotations about fast offerings in them. But the one that stands out to me more than anything else is that if you'll fast and pray and give the equivalent of your meals to the bishop of the church for the assistance of his worthy poor, the fullness of the earth shall be yours. And I've often wondered who wants more than the fullness of the earth for keeping a little law, really, of obedience. If we haven't eaten the food, it hasn't cost us anything. And yet people argue about that. I had a bishop challenge me one day at a quarterly conference, and he said, but Brother Beener, what happens if after you fasted 24 hours, you're so hungry, you don't only eat the meal you're entitled to, but you literally eat the two meals that you fasted? Well, I had two observations to make about that. One was that I thought no medical man would ever give approval to putting three meals where there only ought to be one. I think most of us have overeaten a little sometimes, and we've felt the uncomfort from that. But the other was, I don't care how much you eat when the fasting period is over, just don't you eat the Lord's two meals. And I thought that was pretty good advice. You can have all you want, and the Lord and His people get His share, and then on top of that, you get the blessings that come from keeping this law. Well, now, let me tell you what some people do. One bishop recently, and I don't think he had any approval to do this, but out of it have come some wonderful things, tested some of his families to see how well they had been listening to putting away a year's supply. Why a year's supply? That sounds tremendous. He said, we're calling this family and this family over here to live off of their supply for 2 weeks. And you know, some of them were in difficulty in 2 days. Do you know one of the commonest things that no one ever had? A yeast cake. They had flour, they had wheat, they had a lot of other things, but they couldn't bake any bread. a yeast cake. And they found a lot of the very other simple staple items that when they had to live on what they had made it rather difficult because they hadn't listened too well. So while you're not in that problem now, one day you might be. And maybe voluntarily you can live a week on what you have and then discover what you'd like to eat, what you'd like to live on. Then you put some of those things away. And when that comes to you, then you'll know what's in your larder and what your diet's going to be for that week. I hope it'll never, ever have to come when we'll be tested and we'll have to live entirely out of our storehouse. But if that time comes, and I see no reason for telling us to do those things, unless maybe sometime in the future things like that are going to happen. I'm going to close with just a little experience that I had when I was the president of a stake and how we acquired our welfare project. We had been talking for quite a while of acquiring a bakery. I had observed that we had hundreds of widows being assisted from the bishop's storehouse. I, for one, couldn't see the advisability of giving them a 50-pound sack or a 100-pound sack of flour to bake one loaf of bread at a time. Some of them didn't have the facilities on which to bake a loaf of bread. Some had no way to store their sack of flour. And I felt that if we could provide a bakery and each day or every two or three days give these persons a loaf of bread and maybe something else that a bakery could produce, it'd be a fine addition to the bishop's storehouse. One day, a very prominent medical doctor in Salt Lake City called me up and said, "Are you President Beener?" And I said, "Yes." "I understand you're acquiring a bakery for the welfare program." And I said, "Well, we've done considerable talking about it. We're very interested in it." He said, "Well, I have one I'd like to give you." And I wondered if I'd heard right. He said, "When can I show it to you?" And I said, "Oh, I can go with you tomorrow or next day." He said, "Tomorrow or next day? What's wrong with going right now?" So we got together and he took me down in the southern part of Salt Lake City, saw a big electric neon sign out that said Highland Bakery. It had closed its doors the night before. His baker had quit. He said, "I'm so busy in my medical profession, I haven't time to supervise this any longer." We went inside and saw the showcases, the cash registers, the boxes to put in cakes and pies, a big deep freeze full of popsicles, milk nickels, quarts, half gallons and gallons of ice cream, 30 or 40 cases of soda water, and everything in a going concern. We walked in the back, and here were the electrical mixers, stacks of flour, sugar, syrups, everything that it took to bake the finest kind of pastry. And as we looked at the whole situation, the doctor said, "How does it look to you?" And I said, "It looks wonderful to me." And he reached in his pocket and he said, "Here's the key. I don't own the building. I have a lease on it for 6 more months, but everything else in it is yours. And if any bills come in the next few days, just send them to me. The baker's been buying his odds and ends as we go along." I said, "Doctor, aren't you a married man?" And he said, "Yes." "Do you have children?" "Yes." I said, "Why don't you take home some 100-pound sacks of sugar and some 100-pound sacks of flour? Why don't you take home the soda water and the ice cream? You're giving us enough." He said, "If I'm going to give this to you, I'm going to give it to you lock, stock, and barrel. I want nothing for it. I'm grateful to do that much for the welfare program." That night, the stake presidency had one of the most interesting meetings they had ever had. That night, we got a hold of the best baker in Salt Lake City, and within 2 days, we were in business. And we announced to the welfare committee that we had a bakery and we'd like an assignment. And we had, until I moved from that stake, an assignment of baking 88,000 loaves of bread that were distributed among the four regions in Salt Lake City who distribute to the worthy poor every day. Every day they had their fresh bread, and it's still being produced down there. Besides that, there's a nice little retail business that pays all of the expenses. It's one of the finest little projects that I know anything about in the welfare program. Well, I could speak to you long about some of the marvelous blessings I have seen come to members of the church through this program. I bear you my testimony again that these great programs in the church are designed to bless and to strengthen. And the blessings don't all come to those who receive. They come in just as great a proportion to those who give. God bless you and help you to appreciate what your membership in this great church can mean to you. As I know what it means to me, I pray humbly in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.